Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of On Science, the podcast that we bring to you every week here at National Public Radio's Science Desk. I'm Christopher Joyce.
And I'm Joe Palka. Today, we've got dinosaurs with feathers, the story about the melting Antarctic ice sheet. Oh, we love that one. But let's start with cows, as they say in Northern England. Cows.
As I say, cows. And about 6 months ago, our colleague Nell Greenfield Boyce reported on why some cows seem to face one direction when grazing or resting. Now, this is pretty interesting. It turns out that some scientists say cows actually sense the Earth's magnetic field. And now, Nell has done a second story on this topic. You're on a roll about this, aren't you?
I was told not to respond.
No, you can go ahead and say yes.
Break the rules.
Who can resist a magnetic cow story?
We can't, so
Nell's joined us. In case you were wondering who that was Nell. She's here in the podcast studio, and now we're going to hear her story.
Heinrich Berda is a zoologist at the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany. Last year, he and his colleagues were flabbergasted by how much attention their cow study got. All kinds of newspapers and websites discussed the story. Berda got hundreds of emails.
We really didn't expect it and don't know what's the matter, why the cows are so interesting.
He and his team had found that cows tend to align their bodies so they face either magnetic north or south. The researchers used Google Earth to get overhead images of thousands of cows all over the world. And while they gathered those pictures, they were already thinking about another study they could do to investigate how cows react to magnetic fields.
If you are searching for cows in Google Earth or if you're observing them in the field, sooner or later you will see them also under power lines.
High-voltage power lines create local disruptions in the Earth's magnetic field. So Berda looked at over 1,500 cows in more than 150 pastures, all of them under or close to power lines. These cattle seemed confused.
Under these power lines, the orientation of the animals is random in all directions, so it means the animals don't show any preference for north-south direction.
The findings are reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Berda says there's more work to be done, but this adds to the evidence that big mammals, like cows, can be as sensitive to magnetic fields as certain bats and rodents.
Well, that was really interesting, as the first one was. You know, I was reading some of the comments that we get on the website, though, from folks, many of whom are rather skeptical and think that this guy's nuts. What do you come away with on this? Are you a believer?
Am I a believer? Well, you know, I mean,
this is science. We don't talk about faith here.
As much as I believe the scientific method, I'm a believer. I mean, they've done, you know, a lot of different things to try to rule out, you know, things that could mess up their results. You know, a lot of the comments we got online were like, well, any farm boy knows that cows respond to the wind and the sun mm-hmm. and whether they're walking up a slope and all this sort of thing. And, you know, the researchers aren't saying that, you know, the Earth's magnetic field, you know, makes these cows into like slaves that can only point in one direction, right? I mean, we know that they're going to respond to local conditions. But, you know, you look at thousands of cows over the entire globe to sort of do away with those local conditions and try to get sort of trends, you know. I mean, that's what they're seeing is this trend. I mean, another thing people have brought up is, which surprised me, was the issue of cow magnets, which is that some farmers apparently have cows swallow literally large magnets, which are called cow magnets, and they're there to pick up bits of metal and crud, you know, that the cows might ingest while they're grazing. So a cow could be out there grazing and might, like, accidentally eat part of an old rusted fence or something like that, or a nail or something. And, you know, somebody said, well, maybe the cows are responding to the Earth's magnetic field because they literally have magnets in them.
And so,
you know, I thought that was a legitimate question.
Nell, this is a career move for you. NPR's cow orientation correspondent.
So I emailed the researchers, you know, in Europe, and I said, listen, you know, people have brought up cow magnets. What do you think? And I got this long email back, you know, of all the reasons why this was not a concern because, you know, cow owners in Europe typically don't use these magnets. And he had a bunch of other reasons for why they had sort of controlled for that. But people are really interested in this and get, like, strangely, you know, passionate about the subject.
Yeah.
Yeah, strangely is the operative word there, I think.
Now, thanks very much for stopping by.
That was all you wanted from me?
I assume that the end part of the magnet story is that then they poop the magnet out with all the stuff that's connected to it. So that's how they cleanse.
They cut it out when they gut them.
They cleanse the body?
No, they don't poop out the magnet. The point of the magnet is to keep, as I understand it, okay, I'm not an expert on these things. As I understand it, the point of the magnet is that the magnet stays in one part of their digestive system and keeps the metallic elements from moving through the digestive tract.
Until they die.
So, yeah, I think it's there forever.
Huh.
The point of all this, and I think this is what, if you read people's comments on our website, people get confused about, is that the typical response is like, well, I drove by some cows today and they weren't pointing north, therefore this result is wrong. Well, but that's not, I mean, you can't look at a couple cows. I mean, they're going to respond, you know, to where they see some food or they're thirsty, so they're going to walk over here and get some water. I mean, you really have to look at thousands and thousands of cows, which is why their sort of use of Google Earth is kind of,
Innovative.
Yeah. I mean, that's not what Google. That's not what Google Earth is for. And yet, if you go on Google Earth, which I have, and you start looking around, you can find a lot of cows. And you can find a lot of cows under power lines, and you can find a lot of cows under interesting places. And it really opens the question, like, what other animals can you study with Google Earth?
Nell, thanks very much for stopping by.
Oh, sure.
So cows aren't the only animals that have exhibited what we might call animal magnetism. I'm sure people have heard about birds that can keep track of the geomagnetic north and travel thousands of miles on very regular patterns. And my colleague Richard Harris is here from the Science Desk. Richard, you've covered... Where'd you go?
I'm over here. Hi,
you're
Joe.
You're behind that screen. All right. you've covered a lot of these stories. In fact, didn't you do one about the Arctic tern once?
You know, Joe, I've been here for so many years, I cannot really remember all my stories. Well, but
Richard,
done...
you know, one good turn deserves another, so go right ahead.
Well, you're very kind. but I was sort of looking back over some of the stories I've done over the years about animal navigation, and it is amazing that as long as you and I have been at NPR, that they have really made, there are still so many huge, huge questions about how animals migrate and clearly and find their way around the planet. Clearly, magnetism is part of it. That is, some animals have little, or like pigeons have a little bit of magnetite, a magnetic kind of material in their beaks and stuff, which is apparently how they help navigate. But there are all sorts of other tricks that they use. And when you think about it, they have to, because the magnetic poles of the Earth shift around. I mean, over, not from day to day, but certainly from century to century. And if birds sort of remembered where North was, they would very quickly get lost, certainly over the lifetime of their species. So it's a very adaptable system, and people have been trying to figure out what else they do other than magnetism to find their way around. And some birds migrate at night. Many of the little songbirds migrate at night, and apparently they navigate by the stars. But they can even do it on cloudy nights, so it can't always be the stars.
No.
And there's some sense that seabirds, there's some examples of seabirds that actually appear to migrate using smell. They can sort of sniff their neighborhoods and figure, oh, I'm on the right track or the wrong track.
So, Richard, do you think cows migrate? I want to know why cows have this.
I don't know.
You know, it may just be a vestigial thing. There's a lot of stuff that sort of hangs around in evolution. There's no reason to get rid of it, so maybe we all have it.
That's true, although, you know, I don't really have a sense that I could tell you where North was if I didn't have a few other clues. So,
I trust your sense of navigation. 100%. Well, in fact, because we know you found the right direction south anyway.
At least with birds, you know, even if they miss by a few miles, it's not such a big deal.
But I was giving you an intro to the next thing. He knows the direction south.
About to go
south.
There. Okay. Shut up.
All right. Thank you.
So
explained.
Now I lost my train of thought, but I was moving right to that, Joe. Thank you very much for trying to
You're
do
welcome.
The whole show.
It's my pleasure.
They don't have to hit exactly the pole. They can come close. I mean, if they're going south, they could hit maybe the West Antarctic ice sheet or something like that?
Well, yeah, there are not that many birds that do migrate all the way to Antarctica, but actually the bird that has the world's record for migration is the Arctic tern, and they do end up around Antarctica, it's true. And if they had long memories, they could also be telling us stories about what the ice has been doing down there, because the ice has not been static, and that's actually a story that I did this week.
I had a feeling you were going to get to that.
Well, you provided me the perfect entree, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us about what's going on. I mean, this is a shoe that we keep hearing is going to drop, the Antarctic ice sheet coming, dropping off, raising sea level 20, 30 feet, enormous amounts.
But it's a giant shoe, and although we're going to be mixing metaphors, because in my story I call it the Achilles heel, so it's the Achilles heel.
You know, close.
But by the time we're done, we'll have a foot fetish here. But
well, tell us a little bit of context about what's going on before we hear the story.
So what's going on is there are two places on Earth where there is a huge amount of ice that's sitting up above sea level and is not and is keeping sea level where it is, and that's Greenland and Antarctica. And those two places, if and when global warming keeps going, those two places will eventually melt away. And if they melt away, where we live will not be recognizable. I mean, huge parts of the coastline will be just completely obliterated and rewritten.
But some of this, of what you're reporting in the story, is actually maybe it's not as bad as we thought.
Well, it's going to be as bad. The question is when? Going to be as soon as we thought?
And I mean, it's thousands of years after my lifetime. I'm not too worried.
Well, we should try to leave the planet the way we find it, is my philosophy. But point taken, it's maybe not the thing we have to be worried about in the short run. However, the short-run issues, there are some short-run issues I don't mention in my piece, but once you start this melting going, you're not going to be able to stop it. So even if it's going to take a couple thousand years, if you change your mind, it's going to be and decide, oh, we really shouldn't be playing this big an experiment with the planet. It will be very, very hard to undo what gets started.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's turn to the story.
You could call the West Antarctic ice sheet the planet's Achilles heel. It holds a vast amount of water locked up as ice, and it's sitting below sea level, so it's inherently unstable. David Pollard at Penn State University says there's been intense research recently to figure out how the ice sheet has behaved over the past 5 million years.
Before, there was only a vague idea of how the West Antarctic ice sheet grew and decayed over those timescales.
Now a scientific drilling project has brought back sediment samples taken from underneath the ice. That allows scientists to study the mud layers like so many tree rings to show what ice there has done over history.
It's really exciting. They've shown that it really has collapsed and regrown multiple times.
Pollard and a colleague have taken that detailed information and asked what it portends for the future of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
The main reason that it collapsed in the past is the ocean has got warmer around the periphery of Antarctica, increasing the rate of melting of these floating ice shelves which fringe West Antarctica.
These floating ice shelves act like buttresses to keep the much larger ice sheet pinned back. And whenever the shelves melt away, the ice behind them flows into the sea, and sea levels rise. Warming the ocean water around Antarctica by maybe 2 to 5 degrees Celsius could trigger that chain of events again, Pollard says. That degree of warming is not specifically forecast for this century, but at the rate we're heating up the planet, it seems inevitable at some point. The only bright spot in Pollard's study is that the West Antarctic ice sheet won't melt away too rapidly.
It takes about 2,000 to 3,000 years to melt most of it.
So do you feel more reassured or more nervous after having done this analysis?
I'd say I'd feel more nervous.
That's because there's now a clear history showing that this massive ice sheet has melted before under conditions that the Earth may soon again experience. And while the full effect may not unfold for thousands of years, it would transform the planet into a place we would not recognize today. Stefan Rahmstorf at Potsdam University in Germany says there are still so many unknowns about how Antarctic ice behaves that Pollard's study is surely not the final word on this subject.
We certainly don't need a collapse of the ice sheet to cause major problems with sea level rise.
Even if Antarctica contributes little water to the oceans this century, Rahmstorf says that as the seas warm, ocean water will expand. And there's a growing consensus that seas could rise by at least 2 to 3 feet, and quite possibly more, before the end of this century.
Unless, of course, we stop the global warming fairly soon.
Rahmstorf says Europe's global warming policy at the moment is based on a goal to limit global warming to a maximum increase of 2 degrees Celsius, about 4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Just like we have this temperature limit, we should also have a sea level limit.
He advocates setting that at 1 meter, about 3 feet of sea level rise, and no higher, even in the coming centuries. Even if that can be accomplished, many vulnerable low-lying places on Earth would be swamped, Rahmstorf acknowledges, but it's hard to imagine doing any better. And, as the unstable ice of West Antarctica reminds us, we could easily do much, much worse. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Well, Richard's taking the long view there, thousands and thousands of years. We've got a story here from NPR's Danny Zwerdling, who went to the Antarctic, and it took more of a short-time view. He was looking at changes that are happening now, such as those that are affecting penguin life. They're not necessarily all bad, and here's a story that he did for our series, Climate Connections. He visited Cape Royds, Antarctica, where scientists have been studying penguins for 100 years.
We take off from America's main research base in Antarctica, and the helicopter takes only 20 minutes to get to Cape Royds. But it's one of the most spectacular trips in my life. The Earth is blinding white in every direction. We pass a white wall of mountains off to the left. We pass an icy volcano on the right. Steam is curling out of the top. Then the helicopter drops us in a small clearing. We climb a snowy ridge. And there are thousands of penguins. They're crowded together on a mound of black volcanic rock. These are called Adélie penguins. They look like emperors, which were showcased in that hit movie. Only Adélies aren't as big. They barely come up to my thighs. Most are milling around. Some are flopped on their stomachs, on nests which they make out of stones. There are fuzzy chicks, like toys. Our guide is David Ainley. He's one of the most respected penguin researchers in the world. He says he loves studying Adélie penguins, partly because they're so out there, literally.
There's no bushes here. They don't dig burrows. They just sit out here in full view, and they don't really care if we're around. They have no secrets.
It's surprising to hear him talk this way, because researchers usually don't ascribe human emotions to animals. But when Ainley talks about these penguins, it sounds like he's talking about friends.
You know, they're never doubting themselves. Penguins have no self-doubt, of course, which I have lots of for myself.
David Ainley has a thick white mane, white mustache, rugged face. He seems more comfortable with penguins than people. He's been studying penguins over the past 40 years, and he says he's still amazed what Adélies can do. As we're chatting, penguins are filing past us like a line of wind-up dolls. They're heading to the sea a couple hundred yards away, and they're leaping in head first.
Well, they are good examples of how we all should live. They're the epitome of the word dauntless.
These Adélies dive up to 400 feet deep. They dodge giant ice floes the size of cars, which bash around in the surf. Some of the penguins are already coming back. They're shooting straight out of the water, like a circus trick.
Yeah, they can leap 9 or 10 feet.
And all these penguins just did it in one leap. Whoop! Right,
yeah,
on the ice.
Right, kind of like corks.
Scientists say penguins are giving some of the first clues which show how global warming is changing the planet. And Ainley has come up with evidence by asking very basic questions, such as, is this penguin colony growing or is it shrinking? Are the penguins finding plenty of fish to eat, or are they hungry? To get the answers, Ainley arms himself with a syringe, and he loads it with tiny computer identification chips. Then he and his colleagues grab each penguin and hoist it like a squirming dog.
We put them under our arm and hold them tightly. They're extremely strong.
Do they flap?
Yeah, they're very aggressive, and they're very territorial, and they definitely aren't used to being touched by... Well, they don't even want to be touched by another penguin.
Still, the researchers inject a chip in every angry penguin's shoulder. Then they take a computerized scale, which looks like a rubber mat, and they place it on the path so the penguins cross it. And now the system lets Ainley track all kinds of information. For instance, what time does each penguin go fishing? And when does it come back? How much weight did the penguin gain or lose?
It gives us a measure of their condition. If they're lighter than they should be, or they're really heavy, they're doing really well.
Meanwhile, scientists have been doing similar studies in other parts of Antarctica. They've plotted their findings against the climate. And here are the striking results. During the past few decades, climate patterns in some parts of the continent have changed dramatically, and the dailies in some regions have almost disappeared. Their numbers have plunged 80%. Meanwhile, the adelies where Ainley does his research have been doing better than ever.
These penguins are definitely being helped by climate change.
Ainley and other researchers think they know why. Most types of penguins go fishing only in open water, so they're all competing with each other to find food. But adelies catch their fish by diving deep under the ice. In fact, they're just about the only penguin that can physically do that. So when there's plenty of ice over the sea, adelies hardly have any competition, and they can get all the food they want. But now the changing climate is shaking things up. Most of the ice has melted in some areas, so adelies there can't survive. Cape Royds used to have too much ice, but now it has just the right amount, so penguins here are doing great. And Ainley says, here's the moral. Global warming is making life unpredictable. Early this year, he was studying another penguin colony, and a glacier was melting.
Melting, like I'd never seen it before. Those huge rivers running off this glacier, running through the penguin colony. And these rivers were engulfing these penguin nests. And penguins just kept collecting rocks to try to make their nests bigger, raise them up out of the water. And, you know, for many of them, they couldn't collect rocks fast enough, and so their eggs were just washed away. I mean, I thought it was really, really unfair that humans, a long way away, were living lives oblivious to what they're doing to the Earth, to these penguins' home. Not very many.
That's the helicopter pilot calling.
This is Cape Royds, over.
Cape Ainley, yeah, I'm dropping these folks at Evans, and then I'll be over there probably in about 10 minutes.
Okay, we shall be ready.
Roger that.
So we have to make our way toward the landing site. David Ainley says he's coming back to Cape Royds next season. He'll kick off another 100 years of learning from the penguins. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Well, we promised you a story about feathery dinosaurs, and by God, we intend to follow through on that. Chris, we go from Antarctica to feathered dinosaurs. What's the latest?
And back 100 million years or so. True to form, there was a story about something long dead, and I couldn't resist the temptation to cover it. There was a dinosaur discovered in a drawer, in the museum in China. And it turned out, on second or third examination, to have something called proto-feathers on it. And I thought it was interesting because there's been...
Wait a minute. What's a proto-feather?
Well, it's not exactly a feather. It's
I
what
see.
Came
so
before
feathers.
Wait a minute.
Feathers. I promised we would have a story about feathers and dinosaurs, and you're making me look like I'm reneging here.
Kind of. We could fudge on this one.
All right. Go ahead.
For dinosaurs, you know, feathers, they didn't need them to fly. They're not sure what they used them for. But there's a fairly robust, as they say in science, debate about which kinds of dinosaurs had feathers. In the past, they found the so-called theropods and the descendants of the theropods, the big carnivorous meat eaters, the tyrannosaurs of the world. Their ancestors looked like they had feathers, and now they found another fossil from a completely different kind of dinosaur. And that's got them talking a lot about, maybe the ancestor of all dinosaurs had feathers, and or proto-feathers, the beginnings. These are filaments.
Right.
And they're debating as to whether, are these really proto-feathers, or are they some internal organ, you know, that wasn't really a feather? So, you know, paleontologists don't have a lot of money and don't have a lot of specimens, and they have a lot of time on their hands, so they do fight about lots of little things. But
it's a feather. No, it's not a feather. It's a proto-feather. Wait a minute. That's not a proto-feather. I know what a proto-feather looks like, and that's not one. Actually, as we were talking, it just reminded me, do penguins have feathers?
Penguins do have feathers.
Okay, good. Because they're birds, right?
They are birds.
Okay. So
good swimmers.
So this latest feather kerfuffle about dinosaurs follows on other interesting news about dinosaurs that you reported on some years ago in a dinosaur that we are all familiar with.
Yeah, it's the ancestor of T-Rex, and I thought just to put it in context, we'd go back a little bit and listen to a story about one of the other dinosaurs or ancestors of the T-Rex that was discovered.
Everybody pay especially close attention to the last 30 seconds or so of the tape.
No, these are not the kind of feathers you see on a pigeon. They are what scientists call proto-feathers. They're only about 3/4 of an inch long. The paleontologists who found the skeleton with these proto-feathers described them as tubular. From a few feet away, if you were foolish enough to get that close, they would have looked like little tufts. But rudimentary feathers they were, says Mark Norell of the American Museum of Natural History. Norell's team found them on the skeleton of a very primitive tyrannosaur, originally dug up by a farmer in China. It's an ancestor of the famous Tyrannosaurus rex, and the first Tyrannosaurus found with feathers. Norell suspects that the king, T. rex, had them too, at least the young ones. But if you're imagining a 40-foot flesh-eating predator that could fly, relax.
Feathers probably evolved as insulation mechanisms, and that when you're a very small animal, perhaps even, or probably even, you know, hatchling Tyrannosaurus rex, your problem would be holding on to heat, so you're completely covered with feathers.
Norell says adult Tyrannosaurus would have had the opposite problem, keeping cool, so they probably would have shed some, if not all, of their feathers. The feathered tyrannosaur found in China was about 4 feet long and lived 130 million years ago in what is now West Liaoning. The region is famous for rock formations that yield beautifully preserved dinosaur fossils. Tyrannosaur expert Tom Holtz at the University of Maryland says the latest find is the oldest ancestor of T. rex ever found. He calls it the most exciting development in his line of work in the past 2 decades.
The prediction by theory was that if a tyrannosaur were to be found in that formation, we would find the body covering and that covering would in fact be protofeathers.
Holt says he believes the tyrannosaurs probably descended from much smaller, more bird-like dinosaurs. The West Liaoning region is the only place in the world that has yielded dinosaurs with the preserved remains of feathers rather than just impressions of them. 130 million years ago, it was blessed with shallow lakes with fine sediment and lots of volcanoes. Just right, says Holtz, for snuffing out animals and burying them quickly.
These are the conditions that would allow the preservation of the carbonized remains, the films left from the body covering. And that doesn't happen very often at all in the rock record.
Farmers in the region have dug up lots of fossil remains there, including this one. Paleontologist Ching Chu of the Chinese Academy of Sciences has recovered several of them, including a dinosaur with 4 wings. He says the region has become the world's dinosaur hotspot.
Every year when I went to that area, I found some new dinosaur. And every time I think, oh, this is over, there's no more new discovery. But next time when I went back, there will be something else new.
Chinese scientists have named the feathery tyrannosauroid Delong Paradoxus, which they translate as Surprising Emperor Dragon.
Chris, the question I was going to ask you is, from that last part of the tape, is this latest finding that you were talking about with the proto-feathers from the same place in China that one was?
Right.
So
not
he
far.
Was right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He could. That's great.
Liaoning province. I mean, it's turning up not only lots of fossils, but a lot of the, I mean, there's something like 23 types of dinosaurs that they've discovered having proto-feathers or feathers, and a large number of them are from this very province.
All right. Well, that's it for this week's On Science. Join us next week. We'll be back. If you have any questions or comments, you can write to Chris Joyce. His address is... No. Never mind.
Yes, because Joe is going to be over in California for the next few months, so you can reach him personally.
I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I'll be back in a week or so. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you can write to us. The address is... What's it again, Rebecca?
The address is nprscience@npr.org.
Because Rebecca comes over when she gets an email and she goes, oh, we got an email. It makes her so excited. So please write.
And you might get to meet Rebecca if you write.
Anyway, that's it for this week. I'm Joe Palka.
I'm Christopher Joyce.
And that was Rebecca you just heard from.